I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Last week, Governor Larry Hogan unveiled a plan to attack Maryland's growing heroin problem, starting with an emergency task force that meets for the first time today in Annapolis. Statewide numbers reflect heroin abuse and overdoses at new disturbing levels. There were 464 fatal heroin overdoses reported in 2013, and most users were people ages 18 to 26. Last year, Anne Arundel County had nearly one fatal overdose every week. In this hour of Midday, we'll speak to experts on drug treatment about approaches to fighting heroin addiction and overdoses. And we'll hear from a Maryland state delegate who, as a prosecutor in Washington County, has dealt with the growing problem of heroin there for years. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR, WYPF, Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO, Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Last week, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan announced what he calls a holistic strategy to fight the growing heroin problem in Maryland. The strategy includes a $500,000 federal grant, a 10-member emergency task force, which is actually meeting for the first time today in Annapolis, an interagency coordinating council on this problem, and the donation of 5,000 rapid overdose treatment kits, which we'll be telling you about during this hour of the show. The governor said he knows firsthand the cost of addiction. He lost a first cousin to a heroin overdose. Statewide statistics paint a disturbing picture. Since 2010, heroin overdoses have risen 95%. In 2013, there were 464 fatal overdoses blamed on the drug, well over the state's total number of homicides that year. Homicides that year were 387. Anne Arundel County alone reported 49 fatal overdoses from heroin in 2014. And statewide deaths could top 500 when numbers for 2014 are finalized. That's according to the Baltimore Sun. Today, we're going to look at the issue of heroin addiction in Maryland and get some perspectives from a variety of experts. Later in the hour, we'll hear from a registered nurse who runs a residential treatment program in Annapolis and has seen the recent increase in heroin addiction. We'll also hear from a medical expert on approaches to treatment and the need to increase the availability of medication that can reduce the risk of overdoses. But first, we meet Brett Wilson. Brett Wilson is a freshman delegate, member of the House of Delegates from Washington County. He's a Republican who represents Washington County, where heroin use has steadily increased over the past decade. He's also an assistant state's attorney in Hagerstown, and he served on a narcotics task force in Washington County out there. So, double expertise here and headed toward the governor's task force. So, Delegate Wilson, Brett Wilson, welcome to Midday. Nice to have you on the show with us.
Well, thank you very much, Dan, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
You are a member of the governor's task force, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. You know, your role as an assistant state's attorney, a prosecutor in Washington County, I'm glad to get you on here to get the perspective on this, your perspective on this. It seems to me we started hearing more and more about heroin use in the suburbs and in rural areas of Maryland starting about 1999, 2000 or so. Is that your experience in Washington County?
Yeah, Hagerstown actually came a little bit later than that, more around 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. Heroin first started coming into our community at an increasing rate. Before that, I mean, we've always had, unfortunately, problems with cocaine in its many forms and, of course, other drugs. But heroin had avoided us for a bit, and for some reason it was going north of us and south of us, but not into the center of Washington County itself. And then that all changed in the early 2000s, and now it certainly has reached epidemic crisis.
How do you explain it when you look back on those years and that trend into your county and other suburban and rural areas of Maryland? How do you explain it? Because this is a drug that was associated with urban centers, Baltimore City, Washington D.C. for so long.
And you know, I wish there were one explanation for it. Obviously, there's a lot of different circumstances that came about that led to its acceptance among our youth and even among middle-aged folks and older folks who weren't drug users per se until this epidemic came about. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the variety of pain medications that came out that are opiate-based. With the Oxy class, the Percocets, once if you were overprescribed or weren't careful when you're taking your prescription, you could become addicted to opiates. And when the prescription runs out, well, heroin is an opiate as well. And I think that certainly led some people to it. The manufacture of heroin seemed to change also, where they were producing higher grade products, which could actually be snorted as opposed to just injected. And, I think the thought of injecting yourself with a needle certainly kept some people from trying it. But at the same time, when you could take it in a less invasive manner, it made it more available or more, I guess, acceptable to someone who may be on the verge of becoming or thinking about using it. So it's a broad spectrum of causes, but unfortunately they all came together, and now we've got the perfect storm we're dealing with.
I read a recent story in the Hagerstown Herald Mail about the problem in Washington County. The Washington County Sheriff Douglas Mullendore, is that his name?
Mullendore, yeah.
Mullendore is quoted in that piece as saying, it's been kind of all over the county. There's been no area of Washington County that's been unscathed by heroin overdoses. He was speaking of overdoses.
Right.
So as this, we've seen it in Anne Arundel County grow. You heard the statewide figures that could top 500 for fatal overdoses,
right,
in Maryland. So this is continuing in Washington County.
That's correct. And, we do, obviously, it's an easy number to focus on when you talk about the overdoses resulting in deaths. I think the number we should be gathering and looking at is the number of overdoses that are treated and recovery occurs. Because we have a hospital called Meredith Medical Center. It's a wonderful facility. But I know those officials, when we've met, have at times said during certain periods of the year, for no particular reason, they could be dealing with 8 or 9 overdose issues a day. And if we don't capture those statistics across the state, we don't really appreciate how deep this problem is.
What do you think you bring to the table then? What would you like to see the task force address from your perspective?
Well, at the end of the day, I just, my goal is obviously to lend any experience I have, any knowledge I have from the law enforcement side, the prosecution side, the penalty side, the types of treatment facilities and operations that are available through the court system. But my hope for the task force is that it really does get a start at ground level. Let's go into this not knowing anything. As we go out and meet with communities across the state, let's learn everything we can from them, the good, the bad, the ugly, and put that together and really then synthesize it into some type of platform going forward that's going to help us use our resources at the best way possible, and not just on the tail end, the person who is close to overdose state, but also at the front end. What can we do to try and keep people from getting hooked or from trying it in the first place? So it's my goal is, like the governor said, the holistic approach. But I think, to me, that means we're going to look at the entire landscape of addictions and address each and every facet.
Brett Wilson, how long have you been a prosecutor?
I've been a prosecutor almost 13 years now.
And during that time, prosecuted a lot of people for possession with intent to distribute.
Correct.
Yeah. And after all this time, I just wonder if you reflect for a moment about our approach in terms of criminal justice toward the problem of heroin distribution, heroin use, and sometimes they go together. An addict also becomes somebody who sells.
Right. And I call those people user dealers.
Yeah, me too.
Because they are they certainly are selling in order to feed their own addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, Dan, once I started, and I started right at the task force with my first job and went through, it didn't take long to really gain a better perspective of these types of crimes, that we can't look at addicts per se as criminals, okay? It is a crime, and it should be a crime, but at the same time, the way you deal with that person as they go through the system is different than, say, a burglar or a robber. With my perspective, what's really changed is, as I was looking at people who, and we mostly targeted dealers, was to sift through them, find out, is this someone who is a go-between, someone who is going to get a piece to, or sell a piece to get a piece? Is this someone who's doing it for profit? And I definitely, and I'd make no bones about it, I would definitely put them on different type of prosecutorial tracks depending on what their motivation was for selling the drugs that we caught them with.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think Washington County did in terms of providing treatment for those in that category, you know, someone who's actually addicted and not just selling drugs to others?
Well, I can tell you one thing. At our Washington County Detention Center, I believe it was the first detention center in the country to have a jail substance abuse program dating back about 30 years. So we have actually had an in-jail treatment facility as an option for decades now. And we've used that, obviously, for alcohol and then people who are who just are committing driving offenses with alcohol, using alcohol on a regular basis. But we also use it for treating persons on heroin, on cocaine. And there's an additional part of it. We recognize that trauma often goes undealt with in treatment facilities. So they added a TAMAR program, which deals with a person's trauma, which may be the impetus for why they're trying to escape in drugs in the first place. So that is one facility that a lot of counties didn't have, and more are getting them, that we have used as best we can. Beyond that, and I think this is certainly part of the discussion, there aren't as many facilities that perhaps we need to really deal with the number of folks that have gotten to addicted stage.
Yeah, you know, that's where we get community resistance sometimes, almost every time someone talks about opening a treatment center, inpatient, outpatient treatment center, methadone clinic. Communities, although recognizing that there's a problem now that's spread far beyond the urban centers that used to be identified with heroin abuse, don't want those facilities in their communities.
Well, and it depends on which type of facility you're talking about, too. We have one of the, and just to use the slang that I'm not putting a label on it, but this is what some people call it, the drive-through methadone clinics. That model, where you do have people from outside your area coming to utilize the methadone clinic to get their methadone to hopefully stay off of the heroin. And that brings more people to community, and I think that's the type of facility that a lot of communities don't want in their neighborhood. Some of the inpatient facilities I don't think have as much outward effect, and quite frankly, they're probably better based away from an urban center anyway because it's less temptation for the folks that are there.
Yeah.
So, the public, definitely when they hear treatment facility, they're going to raise their ears very quickly. Hopefully, as we explain what type of facility is, people can understand that some may have some outward effects, some may not.
Yeah, you wonder, what is the answer to that, though, the drive-through, show up and get your sip methadone clinic, which we have them in Baltimore City.
Sure.
What's the alternative to that? Make it more accessible in a different way?
Well, honestly, I think that's one of the things that we'll be dealing with on the task force. We need to look at that model and every model, figure out its strengths and weaknesses, and try to come up with a better way. Methadone, I've had prosecuted people, not for drug crimes per se, but people who have been on the methadone clinic rolls for 6, 7, 8 years. So, to a certain extent, sometimes methadone is used to wean a person off. But for some persons, the medical doctor may believe that it is better to have this person, because there's such a high chance of recidivism, better to have them ongoing on methadone. So, we need to look at that as one of the parts to the puzzle and figure out if it's the best model or if we should try to change it.
And one last thing, Brett Wilson, I've been receiving emails the last couple of days from the Behavioral Health Coalition in Maryland, which is a collaboration of non-governmental organizations, nonprofits that are always going to Annapolis advocating for more funds for mental health support in the state, access to mental health. And they're concerned about proposed cuts in the governor's budget that they say would affect behavioral health, specifically treatment for drug addiction in the state. So I have a statement from them I'm going to read about. I'm going to let you go first, but That is a subject that I'm sure you'll be dealing with, or maybe not. I mean, the governor hasn't really talked about adding money to treatment or medically assisted avoidance of overdoses. But I don't. Do you have any thoughts about that? There was no money attached to any of the announcements here, except for a federal grant.
Right, and two separate issues. One, as far as additional funding targeted towards the addiction issue that we have, I think that's an outcome from the task force. Let's find out how we can best spend money or put resources in, and then if we do believe that there's a need for additional, then I'm sure that would be one of the recommendations made to the governor. On the other side, the behavioral services, and you're right, my district, which is just Hagerstown, I represent the city limits basically, we do have a great need for mental health services. We have great people out there working it, and I know that the initial budget as it came out does hit them hard, especially some of the in-home care that helps people stay out and on their own. So as we go through the budgeting process, which is, believe me, it's all new to me, it is something that I'm sure you've seen over the years, can't be explained in a simple paragraph.
Right.
But I know there will be money shifting back and forth. And I've told the behavioral services folks out there that as opportunity arises, I'll certainly be trying to shift funding back to help them maintain the critical care that they provide.
Brett Wilson, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you very
nice
much.
Nice to speak with you. Brett Wilson is a member of the House of Delegates from Washington County, a Republican who also serves as an assistant state's attorney in Washington County, now a member of the governor's new emergency task force on the heroin problem. And let me just quote the statement from the Behavioral Health Coalition. Governor Hogan has unveiled a new program to fight heroin addiction. Meanwhile, there is no additional funding for enhanced substance abuse or substance use disorder treatment. In fact, they say on January 7th, the Board of Public Works approved the outgoing administration's proposal to reduce mental health service, a mental health services rate increase by 2%. The board also approved Governor O'Malley's recommendation for a 13% cut to Medicaid physician rates effective April 1st, and Governor Hogan's budget extends that reduction through July 2016. In all, they say the cuts they're looking at total $23 million in the behavioral health care budget. Again, a statement from the Maryland Behavioral Health Coalition. We're going to take a break here on Midday and talk some more about heroin when we get back. Bethany DiPaola will be joining us, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, for a conversation about proposals to increase access to prescription medications that could reduce the risk of overdoses from heroin. This is the Midday Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. We're discussing Maryland's heroin problem. Last week, it prompted Governor Hogan to form an emergency statewide task force to investigate the problem, look for some solutions, especially when it comes to heroin overdoses. Our guest in this segment of the show is Bethany DiPaola, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and a board-certified psychiatric pharmacist. Her research and teaching focuses on psychiatry and drug abuse, and she has inpatient and outpatient psychiatric and substance abuse practices. She's a very busy person, and we appreciate having you on the show today. Thanks for being here. Is it Dr. DiPaola?
It is Dr. DiPaola.
You worked on a program in Howard County, the Howard County Health Department, the buprenorphine naloxone maintenance program. And I mentioned these two names, the names of these two medications right up front, because in this segment of the show, we're talking about possible solutions to this problem that are medically assisted. First of all, buprenorphine. Let's talk about that just for a minute. We heard a lot about bup a few years ago when it was first being introduced. Some people called it a wonder drug, a possible great solution to heroin addiction. Just describe what that is for our guests, our listeners.
Sure. Buprenorphine is similar to methadone. It is what we call a partial agonist, so it doesn't produce the full effect that methadone does, and that has some advantages to it because it has a little bit less abuse potential. It's less deadly in an overdose situation.
It's meant to reduce the cravings for heroin?
It's meant to reduce cravings.
Just like methadone.
Correct, just like methadone. And they use it for different purposes. In some cases, they use it to detoxify, which is to wean somebody off of an opioid. But what we're really talking about is maintenance therapy. therapy, which is where a person is maintained on a longer-term basis on either buprenorphine or methadone. And there's really good evidence-based data to support that that type of treatment has great treatment outcomes. It improves treatment retention. It reduces or, in many cases, completely eliminates opioid use and relapse. And some of the ancillary advantages, you see improvement in just overall lifestyle, a reduction in criminal activity.
Ability to function.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Let me ask you about the other part of this, naloxone. Now, naloxone I associate with, it's a drug given to paramedics nowadays, right? And
correct.
Some family members of people who are addicted to heroin to save them from an overdose death, right?
Correct. Naloxone is what we call an opioid antagonist. It blocks the opioid receptor. So when somebody overdoses on opioid, they have too much opioid in their system. They're administered naloxone. Naloxone knocks the opioid off the receptor and sits there and does nothing. And that reduces the opioid overdose symptoms. It helps treat the respiratory depression. They don't add naloxone to the buprenorphine-naloxone combination for efficacy purposes. They actually add it to prevent diversion. So when somebody...
What does that mean, prevent diversion? To another drug?
To prevent people from stealing and abusing buprenorphine. So basically, when you add it and you take buprenorphine the way you're supposed to for opioid use disorder, you take it sublingually, you stick it under your tongue, and you wait for it to dissolve, the naloxone is not absorbed. It's not orally absorbed. But if somebody were to take the buprenorphine and inject it, then the naloxone would work, and basically the naloxone would put them in opioid withdrawal.
Oh, I get it.
So it's there to prevent abuse.
And so that gets us to a brand name. Suboxone, S-U-B-O-X-O-N-E, which is a combination of these two.
That is correct.
Okay. So what's going on with Suboxone in our society today, in Maryland or anywhere? Is it being prescribed by doctors? Do you have to go to a clinic to get it? How does it get out there? Because it sounds really effective from everything I've read.
It is effective. And the whole idea behind buprenorphine, there was a change in legislation in the year 2000, the data 2000. And what that law did was it tried to expand access to treatment. Before that, you could only receive methadone maintenance in a specially licensed drug treatment facility. So the whole idea behind Data 2000 was to allow other medications that could come out that met specific requirements to treat opioid use disorder and could be prescribed by physicians in the community. So it was to expand access.
Was there any limit on the number of patients a doctor could take in?
That's the problem.
Oh, there was it? There was a limit.
Yes. A couple of things. Number one, the physicians have to be data waivered. They need to have a special waiver for their DEA license that allows them to prescribe buprenorphine in the first place.
Okay.
And then they have a limited number. So for the first year, you can treat up to 30 patients. And then after that, first year, you can apply to have that expanded up to 100 patients.
Okay, but nonetheless, this is a big change from the methadone maintenance system, which requires you to go to a clinic, right?
Correct. You could go to
your
primary
own doctor,
care.
Your only primary care doctor could prescribe it to you. So are we making any progress when it comes to Suboxone? And I guess in answering that question, I want you to ponder this. A lot of people say, whenever we get into these discussions about methadone or bup, they say, that's not the way to go. You're substituting one drug for another drug. They'll never get off these drugs. This is a maintenance, like you said, a maintenance program. People need to get into a STEP program. They need to get off. They need to get into an abstinence program. And polls show that a lot of Americans apparently think this is the way to go.
And there's a lot of stigma and misinformation in treating patients with opioid use disorder. And one of the big myths that you hear over and over again is that the best way to treat people is not using methadone or buprenorphine. But actually, our literature, when we look at the evidence-based data for pharmacotherapy and what pharmacotherapy strategies work the best, the literature is very poor with detoxification, which is where we wean people off of medication.
When you say
very
poor, you mean the effective is not as effective?
It is not as effective. In fact, they've compared it to placebo, and the literature shows when you just wean people off, it's really no better than using medication at all, using no medication at all. And when you compare it with methadone maintenance or you compare it with buprenorphine maintenance, methadone maintenance and buprenorphine maintenance have much higher efficacy. So the treatment retention is much better. People stop using opioids. And so that's really, from the literature perspective, the best way to treat people. Unfortunately, there's this stigma that you're substituting one addiction for another addiction.
Yeah, you just heard me say it. That's what you hear a lot of people say. And I guess in the ideal, when you're completely clean, that would be a wonderful reality, but it's not the reality in America.
And the reality is that there are a lot of diseases that require chronic medication. And when you look at diabetes or hypertension, there's no push to start somebody on a blood pressure medication and then 6 months later they have to come off their blood pressure medication. The difference between being therapeutically treated with a medication and being addicted, there is a difference. Addiction requires... Basically, to diagnose addiction, we're looking for compulsive use. We're looking for a maladaptive pattern of use of a specific substance. When you're taking a medication therapeutically, there's no maladaptive pattern of use. You're following the prescription. And because of that, you're seeing improvement in the disease. Now, we monitor patients to make sure that they have good outcomes, that they've stopped abusing substances, that they're attending treatment on a regular basis. If they have good treatment outcomes, we'll continue the medication until a point where it's decided that the patient doesn't need the medication anymore. And in some cases, patients need medications long term.
You're listening to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Bethany DePaola. Dr. DePaola, an associate professor and professor of pharmacy practice and science at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. So let's go back to Suboxone. I mean, I appreciate your explanation of this combination of buprenorphine and naloxone. How would it contribute to reducing overdose deaths from heroin in Maryland?
How would naloxone contribute?
How would that combination drug, Suboxone, give us a scenario about how this would actually maybe, because there's all this public interest in the overdoses particularly, mm-hmm. How would it reduce, say, abuse and possible overdose?
Having patients that are properly treated, whether that be with pharmacotherapy or with non-pharmacologic therapy, is going to reduce the risk for overdose, because the greatest risk for overdose is when patients are out abusing on a regular basis. And so by managing them appropriately, providing treatment to manage their disease, they're less likely to go out and overdose.
To binge,
exactly.
Yeah, because they're not on a regular basis abusing as much as they if they were just on heroin.
And the thing is, with buprenorphine naloxone, one of the things it does is it reduces the pleasure when somebody uses opioids, because it gives them sort of a stability in their system where they already have the opioids there. And so patients are less likely to overdose, because if they do use a little bit, they really don't enjoy it very much. And most of them who are managed on a regular basis know that and have that in the back of their head, that they're really not going to enjoy the opioids.
Do most medical professionals in this field of substance abuse recommend Suboxone using buprenorphine? Versus, say, an abstinence program, if they were making a recommendation to a gubernatorial task force, say, or a court, judges of a circuit court, what would be their recommendations for treatment for heroin addiction?
I think the guidelines clearly suggest that, again, there's good efficacy with both buprenorphine and methadone maintenance. Now, is that a blanket for every patient that has opioid use disorder? No. It depends on the specific patient, what their history is. There are some patients that may not be the best treatment strategy. Just, again, like any disease, there's no one medication, one treatment that's good for everybody. But clearly the guidelines, and any physician or any healthcare professional that is familiar with the guidelines will recognize that these are beneficial treatments and would recommend them for appropriate patients.
One other thing about overdoses, I wrote a story about this in The Sun once about someone who had gone into detox and abstinence for a while and then dropped off. It didn't work. They binged and overdosed and died. Are people particularly vulnerable at that point? People in that situation that I just described?
Absolutely. That is probably one of the greatest places where people are at risk, is where they've either been detoxified, they were using previously, and now they've been weaned off, and they don't really have a good sense of how much they're going to need to get high. They know what they used to use, but they don't know now, and so they put themselves in a situation where they overdose. And the other place where you see that is in the detention centers, where people have been detained for a period of time, they're released, and then they go back to using drugs, and the same thing happens. They end up overdosing.
Now, we talked about doctors being able to prescribe Suboxone, buprenorphine. You think pharmacists ought to have this ability as well, under legal authority of the federal government or the state, whatever it takes. Could you talk about that a little bit? Nurses, do you think this ought to be just more accessible?
Definitely. I think internationally we know that there's expanded access. We're much more restrictive than, say, the UK or Australia as far as getting buprenorphine out there to the patients. And one of the ways in which we can expand access is by loosening some of the legal restrictions and including other types of healthcare professionals that are able to prescribe.
We'll talk about pharmacists, for instance. How would that work?
So pharmacists, not all pharmacists have the opportunity to order medications, but we have something called collaborative drug therapy management. Most states have laws that allow for collaborative drug therapy management, and Maryland is one of them. And this is where the pharmacist works collaboratively with the physician. So in the state of Maryland, we have protocols that are based on specific disease states. I have a protocol for opioid use disorder, and we're able to manage patients under that collaborative practice agreement. We're able to work with the physicians, make changes in the patient's medications, we assist in monitoring, and that helps reduce the physician burden. And that is one of the big reasons that physicians cite for not becoming wavered and not prescribing buprenorphine.
I'm just trying to imagine how that works then. Say I'm a patient, I've abused heroin in the past, but I got on Suboxone through my doctor, a prescription from a local pharmacist who's part of this collaboration you're talking about. Would I be in touch with the pharmacist? How would that work? Would the pharmacist check up on me?
Absolutely. Now, the setting is generally a little bit different than what you think of for the average pharmacist. So we're not talking about necessarily going into a community pharmacy. There are community pharmacists that have some degree of collaborative practice, but the type of practice that I have and many of my colleagues have are in community outpatient settings. So I'm in a health department, and I work
in Howard County, for instance.
In Howard County Health Department, and I work directly with the physicians. So the patients come in, they're part of the health department, and I do med management along with the physicians. And in the state of Maryland, pharmacists cannot call in prescriptions or write prescriptions under their own name. So what I do is work with the physician, and I have authorization to call the prescriptions in under a specific physician's name.
And Bethany DePaula, Dr. DePaula, how do nurses fit into that scenario?
So nurses are a little more independent. They can write prescriptions under their own name, and they can apply for a DEA. However, they fall into the same boat as any other healthcare professional other than a physician, which is in the United States, there's a federal law that prevents anybody who has a DEA number other than a physician from prescribing buprenorphine. They can't become wavered.
So your recommendations, if you get a chance to speak to the gubernatorial task force looking into the heroin problem in Maryland and the increasing number of overdoses, would be get Suboxone out there, number one, and make it more accessible. Promote it more as an alternative to, well, as a way for people to get off of heroin and to avoid overdoses. That sounds like number one.
Absolutely.
And number two, make it available through pharmacists, physician assistants, nurses, nurse practitioners.
Right, and that would need to be addressed on a federal level.
Right.
Obviously, it's not something that can just be addressed on a state level, but having the support on a state level is what makes the difference. There is actually some proposed legislation to expand access that's being looked at right now. And so supporting that will be really important.
Let's take a call about this Suboxone while Bethany DePaula is with us. Taylor giving us a ring here on Midday. Thanks for calling in, Taylor.
Oh, hi there. How are you doing today?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really glad to hear you talking about Suboxone today because I've heard it badmouthed a lot because, you know, there's been some abuse on the street and whatnot, but I personally am a Suboxone success story. I was on a methadone maintenance program, and I found it to be a real ball and chain because I was trying to work a job. I was trying to be an independent contractor. I was a painter, and I had, you know, jobs at various times. And when you're chained to a methadone maintenance program, you get you have to get medicated at certain times, and you have to go to group at certain times. And so I had them detox me fairly rapidly, and I have never been so uncomfortable in my life. It was worse than heroin withdrawal, and I kicked around on my couch for about, 4 or 5 weeks before I finally went to a doctor and asked for Suboxone. And that relieved my symptoms, and I was able to detox myself. And I never felt so liberated in my life that I was able to take my own detox, you know, under my own control and take it at my own pace. And, you know, as I was able to take less and less, and indeed, you know, with Suboxone, you are comfortable taking less and less until one day you just need that little bit, and then one day you don't really need any at all. You feel crappy for a couple of days, and on the third day you wake up in a little bit of a sweat with 1,000 pounds off your shoulder, and it's over. Hmm. It's just over.
It's over, meaning what part is over? You mean you're not, you don't have,
the addiction, the feeling of that. Off your shoulders. Huh. It's gone.
Taylor, thank you for the call. I mean, because this can happen to people over time, as Taylor describes it. Does that sound real to you?
Yes. Number one, I think the literature shows that withdrawal with methadone tends to be more severe than with buprenorphine. That's one of the advantages to being managed. But she brings up a really good point, and this is why different patients may be better for one treatment versus another. Methadone generally involves going to the clinic every day or at least 6 out of the 7 days a week. Buprenorphine is something that can be prescribed so that people come in somewhere between weekly and monthly. And so for certain patients who are going to respond well, it allows them to take care of their children, to attend jobs, etc., that isn't always possible when patients are maintained with methadone. And again, that's why we have two different treatment options. One may be better for one person and one may be better for somebody else.
Bethany DePaula is an associate professor in the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. More on this when we get back, folks. We need to take another break here. When we get back, we'll speak to the executive director of a residential treatment center in Annapolis about Maryland's heroin problem. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here for the Midday Show. Maryland's growing heroin problem brought to our attention again last week when Governor Larry Hogan unveiled what he called a holistic strategy to deal with it. The task force that he formed, an emergency basis to meet and talk about this and come up with some ideas, meets for the first time today in Annapolis. So we're spending a little bit of time talking about the problem. And now we're joined by Helen Rines. We're pleased to have her on the show with us. Helen Rines is executive director of the nonprofit Pathways Treatment Center in Annapolis. And there, half or more of the center's 40 beds are taken up by opiate-dependent patients in recovery. So, Helen Rines, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
You know, the words crisis, emergency, epidemic, I'm careful about the words I use to describe what's been going on in Maryland the last few years and what we're highlighting on the show today. How do you feel about those terms in terms of what you're seeing at Pathways, say, in the last year or so?
Well, I do believe that we are in the middle of an opiate crisis in the county and in the state and along much of the East Coast. And I say that because we have seen a very large increase in the number of patients that are seeking treatment for opiate addiction and particularly for heroin addiction. We're also seeing a very large increase in opiate overdose deaths, unintentional, and the numbers are growing, and the predictions are that the numbers will continue to grow if we don't address this crisis.
And Helen, I'm going to assume that this sounds familiar with you, to you. A year ago on this show, we devoted an hour to the problem of the use of painkillers and the transition from people using painkillers to relieve pain, you know, prescribed by their doctors, to ending up using heroin. And this has become more common. And are you seeing patients with that scenario?
Yes, typically we see that most of our patients started out with prescription painkillers that were either available in their homes, in their medicine chests, with friends, or prescribed to them themselves by their physicians, and found that they became rapidly addicted to it. And then at that point, they started to buy painkillers from other avenues, such as on the street. And when that supply started to get more scarce, they turn to heroin, which there's a rather easy supply, and it's also quite a bit less expensive than prescription painkillers are when you're buying them from the street.
Mm-hmm. Helen, what happens at Pathways when someone comes in having used heroin and is in need of treatment, maybe a court referral, or they've just come in on their own, their families brought them in? What are the steps in that in the treatment?
So our referrals generally call into us. We do a telephone screening with them and decide if we are the right facility for them. So they come in and we do a full assessment, and then we will admit them and we will medically detox them with a registered nurse and a psychiatrist. They're assigned a case manager who then works on all of the psychosocial aspects, because it's not just a matter of detoxing a patient, it's also working on things that they need to do to work on themselves and to make some changes in their lifestyle.
And how often do we see people with the dual diagnosis? What would you say about that?
The literature says somewhere between 60 to 65% mm-hmm. of patients have a co-occurring mental health disorder and a substance use disorder. Here at Pathways, we see more about 80%. We see a lot of anxiety and a lot of depression, some bipolar disorder. And then the question is always, you know, which came first? Was it the substance abuse or was it the mental health disorder? But actually, we are all moving now toward an integrated model where we are treating both at the same time.
I wonder if you had some thoughts about what causes the overdoses. Why are we seeing overdoses? Are people binging? People, they don't know what they're doing with the heroin they get?
Yeah, there are several factors that contribute to overdose. One of them has been that most recently, within the last year or so, heroin has been an additive called fentanyl, which is another very strong opiate, has been added to the heroin. Another one is that once people have a period of clean time from opiates, whether it's a couple of weeks or months or years, if they relapse and go back to using the opiate, they cannot use the same amount that they were accustomed to because their tolerance has decreased. So patients coming out of the legal justice system, out of the jails and the prisons, people coming out of treatment, that have stayed clean even in treatment and then go out and use right away, are at very high risk of an unintentional overdose because of the tolerance having decreased.
Helen, what happens to some of your patients after, you know, after they get started with you at the treatment center at Pathways? What's prescribed for them generally? Can you talk a little bit about that? How do they go about their lives afterwards? Do they get medical assistance as they move along?
Certainly, every patient is treated individually, and so there are many patients that come here that we start on different medications, and then we'll continue with an outside provider when they leave here. We make great use of buprenorphine, Some of our patients will leave here and continue on buprenorphine. That's always a treatment team decision between the medical staff and the treatment team and the patient and, of course, the families, because we involve the families in the patient's treatment, as they've been quite involved as when the patient was using.
Hmm. Are families advised about naloxone, about the use of that?
Yes, we talk a lot with families. We have a very active family program here. We meet with our patients and families once a week. We also have a family wellness program on the weekend, a one-day program and a three-day program, and we do quite a bit of education about naloxone, about overdose prevention, and about how they can help their loved one.
Helen Rines from Pathways Treatment Center in Annapolis, which is associated with the Anne Arundel Medical Center, right?
Yes, we are a wholly owned subsidiary of Anne Arundel Medical Center.
Helen, please stay on the line. I'm going to take a couple of calls from some people who've called in to the Midday Show. Get their comments, and if you want to respond, you can, okay?
Thank you.
And Helen Rines is a registered nurse. This is Mary, a registered nurse, giving us a call from Cecil County.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, Mary. What did you want to say about this?
I am a registered nurse. I work at a detention center in a county in Maryland that has probably the worst heroin issue at the moment. We've had multiple murders. Almost all of them have been related to the drug trade.
Mm-hmm.
I have been at this detention center for 2 years now. We will put addicts who say that they're addicted to alcohol and benzodiazepines on a Librium scheduled detox. Heroin abusers, we detox them with medications for nausea, diarrhea, some Tylenol or ibuprofen, and we get them clean. Now, that said, I do know that there is a rate of inmates who are released that go back to doing drugs again, and I've been told that there was a study with Subutex saying that if they get that while they're in jail, they tend to not go back to the heroin as quickly.
Are you referring to Suboxone?
Subutex.
Is that?
Actually, it could be Suboxone. It's what, like I said, I just heard this. I haven't seen any.
Okay.
I can help clarify that a little bit.
Go ahead, Helen.
Suboxone is a combination of buprenorphine and naloxone, where Subutex is simply buprenorphine.
Just bup. Okay. But Mary, we're short of time. You don't feel that the Suboxone works, or what would you want?
No, not at all. Almost every single inmate who's shooting heroin when they come in, or snorting it, or smoking it, is getting treatment with either Suboxone or methadone. It's almost a joke in our county.
So the best practice is not just to prescribe the medication, because that is certainly not a magic bullet. It is medication-assisted treatment. So it's medication with therapy and treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, recognize that. And we've hear stories and anecdotes, and there's been some press reporting about abuse of buprenorphine, but the idea there was for it to be less abused than methadone, right? Helen, I'm talking to.
You know, I can't comment on whether the idea is that it would be less abused than methadone. It's just an alternative treatment than methadone.
Mm-hmm. I believe that was one of the qualities of it. But anyway, you seem to be, if it's the right person and they get the right medical advice going out of a treatment center, even coming out of a detention center, that it can be effective.
The most important thing is that treatment continues. This is not a disease. This is a disease, but it is not a disease that can be fixed in a 14-day or a 21-day program. So ongoing treatment, whether it's with medicated assisted treatment or not, is the best practice. And the literature tells us that people that remain in treatment, so that could be a combination of inpatient and outpatient treatment or just outpatient treatment, that people that remain in treatment for 90 days or more have a better prognosis of remaining in recovery.
Hmm. Helen Rines, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to get you on the show to talk about this problem. Helen Rines is executive director of Pathways Treatment Center in Annapolis, part of the Anne Arundel Medical Center. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's the first hour of Midday. I hope you learned something here about the heroin problem in Maryland. We will follow up on this because it's certainly a problem. It's not going to going away anytime soon. We will follow up. So please stay tuned for the news, and then we have a whole second hour of Midday for you coming your way after we hear from NPR.